When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's conversant is Ray Williams, who is a philosopher and a detransitioner. And in this conversation, we talk about his autogynephilia, or desire to realize himself erotically as a woman, and how that was a driver in his transition, and how regulating himself via spirituality and a transcendent ethic has helped him to accept himself as a man and as a husband, and to proceed along the path of embracing the body that he was given. Ray is a wonderful thinker, and you can find his work down there in the description. I heavily suggest you check out at least his Twitter, if nothing else. And without further ado, here is Ray Williams.
Things seem to be on the upward trajectory. Yeah.
Good.
Glad
to hear that. Glad to hear that. Speaking about the upward trajectory, what's your life been like?
You want the 10,000 foot picture, or more compressed in the past year? Like, I've kind of been going through a lot of changes lately, and you know, it's kind of, some would say, in rapid iteration of worldview reconfiguration. But
how old are you? About,
I'm 36.
Oh wow, okay.
coming up on 37. So
yeah,
It's been many twists and turns along the way. I feel like I've lived many different lives of various kinds, and we can definitely get into that, particularly with the gender stuff. That's probably been the most salient, switch of trajectory and trends in terms of my life.
When did gender first become an idea for you, or a thought, or a focus of your attention?
It sort of depends on what we mean by gender, but I had, and I still suffer from, autogynephilia, so I'm sure you're aware of that. And that was the impetus of where all my gender stuff comes from. You know, based on my research, I think it's a legit theory. You know, it definitely makes sense of my life, and that started when I was very young. So pre-puberty, I remember, having, daydreams and some fantasies around sort of like cross gender fantasy. And I, had a, this obsessive interest with women's clothing. So that's like the there's different types of AGP. Some are more anatomic. Mine has always been about clothing, so that was sort of the I guess they would call what Phil Illy calls sartorial AGP. So that was, so
what was the meaning or the power, like the feeling of women's clothes? Was it liberatory? Was it creative? Was it quickening?
So when I was really little, I think it was primarily sensation based. So I always had an issue with scratchy fabrics when I was young. So I didn't like, the tag on the back of my shirt. I was always picky about, wearing t-shirts with like scratchy textures. Like, I always wanted my clothing to have a certain texture. And I think women's clothing just, it had a certain, like, it's very like a physical sensation of just, and the type of clothing that sort of kicked it all off in my head, as far as like it was like very fetishistic in the sense of being, oriented with regards to one particular type of clothing in the beginning, which was, hosiery. That was sort of the thing that really my mind sort of latched onto, and the sort of like classical fetishistic conception of like having a paraphilic orientation towards a specific object, which in this case was hosiery.
If you go back to like Robin Hood times, at least Robin Hood men in tights, like that wasn't necessarily a female article of clothing. It is now. If you think if you were in a different cultural climate, would the hosiery decoupled from femininity or being restricted to female, would you have a different relationship to it? Or do you think like because
Very,
it
very
was.
likely. I think the taboo aspect, the fact that that was an article of clothing that only women wore, because I think, I can't remember if it was like Michael Bailey or Ray Blanchard said this, but if there was like a society where the only difference between men and women is that men wore four buttons on their coat and women wore five buttons, the AGPs would want to wear that fifth button. So it's really about the taboo associated with, these binary limitations of like, this is like stuff that only women wear. Because I mean, it's not, I think it would have been unlikely to develop in regards to like jeans, for example, because jeans are sort of like a unisex clothing in our modern society. But I don't know, maybe like 200 years ago, it would be petticoats or something, because that's like a very particular, I think it has to be sort of tied into social taboo to sort of like unlock. But I don't know, this is all very speculative in my mind, but
Well, taboo, I just wonder if there's something about shame, like the intensification aspect of shame in or with regard to sexuality. If it wasn't a taboo, like, would it have the charge? Is taboo like linked to feeling shameful, secret? And then
I think
how did you
so.
develop, or how did you deal and cope with that feeling of intense shame or taboo or violation?
I think there definitely was an element of shame. I remember feeling deep shame, feeling guilt. It was very secretive, and I think this is a thematic motif of many people who cross-dress, particularly, like the AGPs. Like it's sort of like, it's always a secretive thing. It's sort of done in the privacy of, your own, private life. You kind of, you don't tell anyone, because you kind of have an intuition that this is wrong in some specs. Like it's sort of like, that, it's just like a message. I grew up in a traditional Christian household where that was, the message. And we can get into it later in regards to, I ended up rejecting that Christian belief system, but recently I've returned to it in a interesting twist that connects to AGP. But at the time, it was definitely like, feelings of shame, and that shame led to a kind of, it led to eventually like this, I think it's like a binging, purging cycle, which is very common with AGP, where you sort of like go through this indulging phase, and then you feel a lot of shame, and then you sort of like throw it away and like swear you'll never do it again, and then you like struggle with the temptation again, and you sort of like go through these like cycles, and then sort of eventually the frequency between the cycles sort of shortens, and to the point where you just kind of like give in, at which point the ultimate giving in is like transition itself, which is like what I ended up doing when I was 28 years old. Was, at that point I had recently gotten divorced, and so I had no family, no responsibilities. I was kind of in grad school. It was kind of like a open-ended world to satisfy this itch. And also there's like a cultural zeitgeist factor in terms of it's like 2015, trans tipping point, and it's like Laverne Cox was on Time magazine, Caitlyn Jenner was like on the air and doing these interviews, and so it was sort of like this zeitgeist of like, oh well, like I'm struggling with these things, maybe I'm not a crustacean, or maybe I'm like a trans woman. And so that identity, I kind of latched on to that identity because it was the social mechanism through which I could publicly legitimize these desires and live a, quote unquote, respectable identity that is not just like tolerated, but positively celebrated by society.
Yeah. There's a, I just wonder about the convolutions. If shame is the intensification of the pattern of obsession of with regard to the paraphilia, let's just use those terms for the time being. And then you embrace that and you come out with that identity, then where does the shame go? And are you still compelled in the same way? Or is it the hope that by becoming this, by fulfilling this desire, like you'll find harmony, peace, resolution, culmination of like this satisfaction, gratification, then you can let it go, baby. You're free. It's freeing.
So this is a common thing that transgender activists who are critical of the autogynephilia theory say is like, well, once you transition, like, all this sort of fetishistic shame goes away, you sort of live your authentic life. And so it can't really be like a fetish. It can't really be a paraphilia, because once you live your authentic truth, then like, the shame aspect goes away, the like sexual component goes away, the sort of eroticization of it goes away. But I think part of that eroticization aspect comes from the fact that it is sort of done only in, these certain contexts. And then once you sort of, as they say in the community, go full time, you normalize it and you're sort of wearing, you're doing this all the time. It sort of habituates your mind to the novelty. Cause I think it's not just shame and it's not just the paraphilia. It's the fact that it's a novel stimulus, I think, is the key aspect. So it's the combination of taboo and novelty that drives the fetishization. And so once you remove the novelty aspect, because you're doing it all the time, it sort of diminishes the taboo aspect and it like kind of removes some of the fetishization component. But I think it just sort of like, so I think it's part of it, but I obviously don't think that falsifies like the theory of AGP, which I think is more about what are the origins of this as opposed to like describing the full lifespan of like the, the indulgence, if that makes sense.
Yeah. There is a, there's a quite famous YouTuber called Philosophy Tube who,
yes, I'm aware,
befriended Natalie Wynn, part of this, this group of, collectivist group of this loose association people called Bread Tube, and Abigail Thorne wasn't always Abigail Thorne, but they transitioned, and a clip of them surfaced a few weeks ago of them saying that this year, it was on the January 1st or whatever, there was a tweet about how this is the year where transphobia is going to be punished. We're not going to allow, we're coming after your jobs if you're in media, entertainment, or education, or anything else, but it was really interesting that they chose those three things, because that's what they think is the most important thing in the world, is this information. Anyways, and then I kind of just like bagged on them a little bit, or like performed a little bit of pushback on Twitter, and they blocked me, like they would block my puberty if they had the chance. And and then I looked a little bit more into them, and I saw them at this, or somebody made this clip of them at this rally, like just, like doing this trans rights activism. And they just overlaid, whoever did this, overlaid like this Hitlerian speech to it. And it was just the same kind of emphatic, power-hungry, domineering, totalitizing, tyrannical modality. And I'm wondering, this is the question, I'm wondering if trans rights activism is a way to take that shame that was fueling it and like put it into, it's still an intensification. I'm right. I'm oppressed. I'm fighting for my rights. You know, it's now, it's not enough to just like, it doesn't normalize it coming out. Like, if there was that shame aspect that was an intensification of the sexual urge and impetus, and if that is, if going public takes away that shame, then does one find themselves, was it the case for you that activism, trans rights activism, was another way of intensifying, it kind of swapped it out, like that shame now becomes outrage or something like that?
Yeah. I think you're getting at something that's important, but I would say it's not necessarily related to the shame of the fetish itself, but another aspect that I think plays into the sort of like pathway towards which a lot of, I think, you know, males who struggle with AGP sort of deal with, which is internalized misandry. Because, you know, if you're one of these, you know, because like a lot of the you know, males who transition are kind of left of center. They're kind of your more feminist sensitive men, and they sort of grow up in these feminist circles. And a lot of them, you know, I don't think it's a surprise that a lot of the bread tube, almost every like male bread tuber has like non-binary or transition or something. Yeah. Because there's this sort of like internalization of the messages from pop feminism, men are trash, you know, check your privilege, you have male privilege. And it's, and so, and especially if you're, you know, white and straight, like you're at the pinnacle of the oppressor pyramid. You're like the most evil person on the entire planet because you're cis, straight, white, male. Yeah. And so I think there's a desire to sort of identify out of that oppression. So you might still be, you know, white, but hey, now you're a lesbian. Now you're not no longer cis, and you're not even male because now you're like, you know, you're trans feminine or whatever. So I think that sort of, and that plugs you immediately into this decades long, like, you know, rights, you know, we're on the right side of history, this activist, you know, liberatory struggle. So I think if there wasn't that sort of liberation movement based on internalized misandry, I think, you know, there, the rate at which people dealt with these AGP feelings through the adoption of a trans identity would be different. They would just sort of, you know, cope with it in a different way.
Okay. Yeah. The phrase or the term, internalized phobia, androgyny, whatever. I'm always kind of like wary of it. Because it can be kind of like a social justice term or like a term used to, control other people, especially when people accuse other people of like, oh, that's just your internalized misandry. Or you see it a lot in the feminist circles where if a woman disagrees with the prevailing wisdom of the feminist movement, then they're saying like the only reason you could possibly disagree with all these other women is that you hate women on the inside. So it can be used as in not good faith, which is for everything, but I'm always wary of that term. But I have seen in my interviews with males who have attempted transition and backed out of it, or detrans males, there's a pattern, the ones at least I've spoken to, and that is, you know, that's the bias of, what's that one scientific term, like not confirmation bias, but it's just, I'm only going to speak to a certain type of person because
it's just
the sample, sampling bias, but that they are, there is a propensity for sensitivity, and there is a, not only is there, insofar as they claim or identify with the AGP label and the way that classification, that sexuality, there's a desire for the feminine and there's a dread of the male. Like, there's not just a desire for women. There's also like a deep discomfort with maleness. And sometimes it has to do with the father figure. Sometimes it has to do with they see in the world that men are depicted as the aggressor and they want to flee from that. There's all these other triggers going on. It's not just, I want to colonize femininity. It's, I want to escape masculinity too. There's something about right. that. I'm wondering in your, if you want to go here, you kind of opened up about your sexuality. It's very personal, but like, what is your relationship to manhood and how was that a part of your transition and how have like over the course of your detransition, have you incorporated or integrated manhood back into your life, to your identity?
Yeah, that's a, it's a good question. And, you know, I'm like definitely sensitive to your like sort of reaction to that term and internalized misandry, because yeah, it kind of fits into like the standard lingo, but yeah, I think it's just a like a buzzword for like, yeah, like you said, like a dislike of masculinity, a dislike of your maleness, and that's sort of like, and yeah, I don't think I grew up with this like overbearing rejection of masculinity, but I sort of resonated with this idea that was popular in like intellectual, academic, liberal, progressive circles, which is that, you know, yeah, that like men are sort of the root of the problem. So it's like, if I had an identity at all, it wasn't necessarily as like a man per se. It was like as a human. I would sort of like have a more generalizable, like, yeah, I'm just like the, like a human. I'm like, you know, I sort of like have every other identity label except like a positive conception of myself as a man. And also growing up, because I was more of a bookish intellectual type, I sort of had trouble relating to your sort of like, you know, typical blue collar masculine men. And in that sense, I felt sort of alienated from, you know, the sort of like stereotypical traditional masculinity. And, you know, I was a metalhead. I had long hair. I had like my ears pierced. I, you know, sort of like slightly resonated with, you know, terms like metrosexual. I cared about like my hygiene.
Not a Hesher, you know, but a metro Hesher.
Yeah. So yeah, it was sort of like, I don't think I developed a healthy appreciation for men. I always sort of, you know, wanted to ingratiate myself with the feminist. I was in like, you know, philosophy departments and like academia. So, you know, I wanted, and when you are in those sorts of environments, you're not really supposed to talk in terms of positive conceptions of masculinity, because hashtag toxic masculinity is sort of, and they always say like, well, not all men, you know, but they sort of did mean like all men. So that's sort of the implicit read between the lines, yeah, like context in terms of like, there's something inherent to manhood and maleness that is just like permeating from, you know, and so the job of a good man is to constantly recognize how toxic, or it's the job of a good man is to be conscious and critical of your potential to be toxic. That's like where you're
disrupt and dismantle, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And then to answer your second part of the question about, you know, since I've detransitioned, like developing, you know, not just like a acceptance of the biological reality that I am male, which is something I definitely flirted with rejecting in a sort of like postmodern deconstructive way of like, well, you know, like what does male and female really mean? You know, in a sort of Judith Butler sort of way, but sort of not just like accepting that I'm male, but like appreciating it, enjoying it, like embracing it, and the corresponding, you know, concepts of manhood and starting to learn like what is it to be, you know, not just a man but a good husband, because I met my wife when I was transitioned, and so we got married as, you know, two wives. Well, now I'm like a husband, so it's like what does it mean to be a good husband? And you know, in recently I've come to sort of you know, really, I guess, and the evangelical term would be rededicate myself, because I, you know, I raised Christian, you know, I just got saved a long time ago, but I sort of like rededicated myself to, you know, to Jesus and to that, and that sort of religious biblical conception of, you know, manhood and the role of the husband to be self-sacrificial to the wife has really sort of given me a positive conception that's not just relative to the arbitrary cultural whims of society, but is sort of grounding that gender role in something that I now perceive to be a objective moral obligation and not just something I'm like, you know, oh yeah, I just, it's not coming out of my own whims and desires, but now I perceive that to be a moral obligation. Yeah, and yeah. The failure to live up to that moral obligation is to me a very serious thing. Whereas previously I never really took stuff like that seriously.
Wow. Gender is a social contract as opposed to construct. I was on vacation with my dad. Well, my family and my mom and dad came along, and my dad was hanging out with my stepsons. And they took him out, and then they came back, and one of my stepsons said that my dad said that there's two kinds of history. There's the history of what happened, and then there's the history of ideas. And I guess like an interview such as this is a mixture of those two, but I'm really interested in your trajectory as an intellectual. Like, it sounds like you did philosophy, then you did grad work. So where did you start with this intellectual life, and what were you concentrating on, and what was your trajectory through the halls of the longhouse halls of academia?
Yeah. So I have an undergraduate degree in interdisciplinary studies. My concentrations were in philosophy and psychology, and I had a minor in cognitive science. And that was sort of what I was always interested in, was that sort of intersection between philosophy and psychology.
Yeah.
And then I got a master's degree in philosophy, and I studied the continental tradition of like phenomenology. So I wrote like a master's thesis on like Martin Heidegger. So I was in that kind of continental phenomenological tradition where I really familiarized myself with, you know, that whole phenomenological tradition, like Foucault, Derrida, you know, all that sort of people, which was sort of provided fertile ground for, you know, when I eventually went full blown, you know, postmodern during my, and then so after the master's thesis, I was in a PhD program where it was a philosophy PhD program, but it was called the Philosophy Neuroscience Psychology PhD program. So I took like neuroscience courses and stuff, and I was originally interested in consciousness studies. So that was sort of the my main focus for so many years was like consciousness. That was like what I was obsessed with. But then in my fifth year of grad school, I transitioned, and then suddenly I like switched from consciousness studies to now I want to write on the ethics of transgender healthcare, because that's what I was obsessed with, was transness. I just like transness took over my mind. So wow. I started reading about feminism and gender studies and queer theory and like trans studies and trans feminism and like, you know, all these sort of like gendery topics, And but my interests have always been very interdisciplinary.
What's the phenomenology of transness?
A lot of neuroticism, a lot of anxiety.
Really?
Well, yeah, I mean, at least in my own personal experience, yeah, especially those like early years, like just, I'd say the predominant phenomenological theme of trans experience from what I can gather, not just in my own experience, but from like just lots of research on this and talking to and like reading like literally thousands of like internet posts and just talking to people, it's all about anxiety over passing. So that's a sort of passing is the fundamental like motif.
Could
And
you describe that in philosophical terms? Is there like either a metaphor or like something in the history of ideas that would be similar to this? This passing, like there's such a. I know the mechanics of it. Like you're trying to figure out like is this male or not female? Am I going to be perceived by this or that? But like just as an idea, like is it this idol? It's like this idol, but it's not an idol. It's this moving idol. It's this amorphous,
it's
all-consuming
wanting to
God.
be something you're not. That's how I would describe it. It's anxiety about wanting to deeply, fundamentally be something you know you're not, and that generates anxiety. And then the more you achieve passability, the more it just heightens the potential anxiety of being found out. Because let's say you pass at the grocery store, at the bank, you sort of can, reasonably approximate, whatever target gender you're trying to pass as. Well, the quote unquote cisgender target is still the gold standard, because let's say you're on a date and you're passing. Do like what happens when you get to the bedroom? Have you had, your surgeries? And now you have to like, there's anxiety about, well, when do I come out? When do I tell? And so there's two sort of pathways. I think there's one instinct, which is like, I want to be as deep stealth as possible. And I want to, and it's just like a private medical thing in my past. And like, that's why people say like, I'm a woman of trans experience. And trans experience is just refers to this, like, it's like a private medical condition. It's like, oh yeah, I'm just like any other woman. I was just like born with this medical anomaly when I was like a baby. And so there's this instinct to sort of go deep, deep stealth, which always raises an anxiety of like, well, what happens when you just want to start a family? Do you tell your partner? And so you sort of just push off the anxiety to like a future state. And then I think the other instinct is this sort of coming out of modern queer theory, which is to deconstruct cisgender as the gold standard, to say, well, no, it's not the standard. We are our own standard, and which is why you have a lot of trans people who don't care about passing or say they don't care about passing, because they'll say like it's toxic, it's transphobic to elevate, cisgender people as the target that you're trying to emulate. They say like, well, no, we're on a even normative playing field, which is why you have people like Julia Serrano coming up with these concepts like cisnormativity as a sort of it's like a bias. It's like, oh, you're just biased to think that, cis people are the standard, but if you correct your internalized transphobia, then you'll realize that you're on like equal playing field, and the trans identity is equally valid to the cis identity. But that's all good and well to talk like that, but I feel like most trans people are kind of somewhere in between, and it just kind of generates like perpetual anxiety.
And you are, by the act of transition, expressing a target. You are reifying that which, on an intellectual plane, you might be deconstructing. But like through the process of feminization is a target. It's a goal, and you have to actually intensely intentionally reify it and play it out and act it out and make it second nature to you, right? Like the way that you move your hands, the way you walk through a room, the way your voice acts, the way you hold yourself. What is that assembled out of other than sex?
Yeah. Well, this is where the sort of rubber hits the road with these sort of like abstract Judith Butler type conceptions of sex and gender, where they want to like say sex is just as constructed as gender and it's all arbitrary and it's all just drag. We're all just doing drag. Like, you know, cis people are doing drag, trans people are doing drag. We're all, life is drag. And I think that sort of, you know, I think people sort of want that, they want that to be true because it eliminates the anxiety that comes with passing. And, you know, there's definitely trans people who are not as anxious about all this stuff and sort of are able to sort of, you know, integrate these anxieties into, you know, like such that they eventually kind of, the anxiety settles a little bit and they're able to stop thinking about gender all the time. And their expressions are a little more authentic. But I think with trans women, like, I mean, this is a classic gender critical critique, is that it's an artifice. It's constructed, like, just like, you know, like voice training, for example, you kind of have to impose an artifice of like, I don't know. It's like you sort of, I mean, in my own case, I studied femininity to emulate it. Like I was like a bird watcher studying birds. Okay. it's very like intentional. Like I'm going to emulate this, you know, I'm going to change my voice. I'm going to like, you know, and it is very intentional and constructed. And I think for some, not for all, you know, for some, I think the more like homosexual, transsexual types, this sort of femininity comes natural and it's not as artificial. It's not as put on. But there are some trans women who don't do any effort to put on the artifice. They just sort of like adopt the entity or the identity, but they don't sort of attempt to change anything else.
So, in your intellectual life, you switched from consciousness studies to trans medical care. What was your thesis, or did you end up, getting a thesis or like what
no,
were you doing?
I ended up activism dropping kind of out stuff, in my sixth year. My thesis was I was trying to defend a radical informed consent model of trans healthcare. Which, you know, I never was able to develop a philosophically sound argument to support that view because my professors, to their credit, you know, would always push back with, you know, counterexamples to that model. They would say like, well, if you have a truly radically informed consent model, you know, what if someone just like wakes up one day and like, you know, like yesterday they don't have a desire for bottom surgery. And then like the next day they wake up and suddenly they want bottom surgery. Should they be allowed to just waltz into the surgeon's office and say like, I demand this, give it to me. And then the surgeon does it because they signed the paperwork and they're not in a clearly psychotic state or whatever. And the objection that I had was like, well, that's not practical because in reality there's waiting list, and the waiting list, because there's like backups, you know, you sort of have like 2 years to, you know, go through the waiting list process, and it's sort of like the practical limitations of this health system sort of like put in check and balance in terms of like, you know, but yeah, but they would say like, well, no, this is philosophy. You can't just rely on like the pragmatics, you know, you have to like bite the bullet. And like, are you really going to say that if you wake up one day and let's assume there's like a gender surgeon on every block and there's no waiting list, like, would you really like, you know, say like, yeah, today I want to get bottom surgery. I'm just going to walk into the surgeon and get it. And that seems unintuitive. So you have to have some gatekeeping. And then the question is like, okay, well, if you're going to put in some gatekeeping, like what is the criteria to judge someone is truly trans? And the only solution I could ever come up with was not any sort of like principled philosophical criterion of like who's true trans and who's not true trans, but it was like, you really, my solution was just like, we need more better therapists, but that's not a philosophical conclusion. That's just a pragmatics of like, we need a better healthcare system, but that's not philosophy. So eventually I gave up on the thesis and I couldn't defend it. And the project sort of fell apart and I ended up like dropping out anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Is there like in the meantime, have you played with ideas? Has it come to you, eureka moment? Like, oh, this is how there's a philosophically sound argument for transness or trans medicalization, or did it go the other way and like you're like there's actually nothing, there's no there like on a philosophical level?
I'm leaning more towards there's no there. I mean, I think it depends on what there we're talking about, because if the question is, are there people who genuinely suffer from this desire to, you know, cut off their genitals? Yes, there are some people who have this intense desire for that, but whether that makes you true trans, because a lot of people try and like come up with these, you know, distinctions like, oh, well, if you're AGP and you have a paraphilia and that paraphilia makes you want to cut off your genitals, then you're not true trans. But if you're of the homosexual type and you have that same desire, then you're true trans. Well, I think that's arbitrary. And then, you know, it's like, oh, well, if the desire manifests when you're like 3 years old, then it's real. Well, I think that's also arbitrary, because why is it, if the desire manifests when you're three, but if it's manifest when you're 15, like is 15 no longer too trans? Like where do you draw the line?
And then if you talk about a three-year-old, are you like in what decade is this three-year-old existing? Like 1890s or 1990s,
right?
Or 2020s? Because 2020s, yeah, you are trans, but there's also a historical point of view for this. Did you investigate that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I used to buy into the idea that, you know, the like common activist line is like, you know, trans people have always existed and, you know, we've always been here. We just didn't call it trans, but I sort of, you know, I think we have to sort of distinguish between also the male population and the female population, because I think the underlying paraphilic, you know, I think there's good reason to think these underlying paraphilic desires, you know, that constitute AGP have some sort of innate disposition. I think it's always a combination of nature and nurture. But if we're talking about the young female population and the manifestations they have for these desires, I think they're much more amenable to cultural influences. So we have to sort of like really tease out like the finer distinctions of which like demographic we're talking about, like, you know, young females who are having maybe like RGD or versus like, you know, young AGPs who have these intrinsic, you know, paraphilic motivations versus like, you know, the homosexuals who, you know, in another decade, they would just be like, you know, flamboyant, you know, like gay men or something. Like, so I think we have to sort of tease apart all these things, but I'm very skeptical that there's like a way to define true trans. And at this point, I basically say like, the only consistent definition of someone who's trans is, do you self-consciously choose the term trans and apply it to yourself? Unless they're like, well, yeah, they're just trenders. What they, you know, trenders are part of the trans phenomenon these days.
Is there, so I guess the philosophical tact would to, well, I don't know. You're the philosopher. I'm not a philosopher. So, but I'm just thinking like this transsexual, there's no such thing as a transsexual anymore. Nobody calls it transsexual anymore, even though it's implied. Transgender is the accepted term because English has a problem with the word sex and sexual because it's got two meanings. Well, it's got one meaning that just associates itself with these other biological factors. But there's also this transhumanism stuff. And I think I think some of the work that James Lindsay has done around popularizing the idea that there's this historical force called Gnosticism and Hermeticism, and it pops up over and over and over again. And I know these are all technical terms. I'm going to butcher them by saying that there is a Luciferian urge in modern Western man to put his will above everything else. And with technology and science, man becomes more and more capable of telling the world what to do, telling his body what to do, and transcending his flesh through an act of will and technology. So that would be like the philosophical / narrative mode of understanding what is fueling it as a sociological phenomenon. And to understand it first and foremost, and then to admit, I think we have to admit that with technology being where it's at, medical technology being where it's at, people are going to be transitioning into dragons. They're going to be transitioning into robots. They're going to be transitioning into anything that they want to do. It's going to happen. We can't really stop it because the technology is going to be there. We can regulate it. We can make opprobriums on it on a social level. We can push back against it, but we have to admit that it's here. It's here to stay, especially the detrans cohort. Like, society's going to have to reintegrate or allow for passive reintegration of the male to the female to the male and the female to the male to the female. And where these medically altered gender humans are going to be accepted, embraced, and then understood. So, I'm wondering, I guess I forgot the question, and something flashed on my screen that distracted me, but there's got to be a phenomenologically speaking, or like, could you just respond to that phenomenologically, yeah, blah, totally, blah, blah, whatever.
This is go for like, it. So I'm not sure if I mentioned this before, but you know, during my trans activist days, I actually wrote a book on transfeminism. There's a collection of essays, and one of my essays was on transhumanism and biohacking as like the future trajectory, yeah, of like, I wrote this back in like 2018. And like, yes. And I think the availability of these technologies is part and parcel of the like social construction of the category of transness, because but if we just sort of like roll back the, you know, the historical tape, and we postulate another world where, you know, synthetic hormones and these gender technologies of surgery were never invented, I do not think we would see the demographic explosion of transness. I feel like having the possibility of the synthetic hormones as a, like, once you see that, hey, it's possible for me to take these hormones, I think that can create desires that otherwise would not there. It's not, I don't think we are necessarily born with a desire to take hormones, but the technology of the hormones, like once you see that it's a possibility, yeah, that creates a possibility model. And now that you have the possibility model, it creates a desire in response to that possibility model. So,
wow,
you know, these technologies, like, and then there's a great book by this, a trans masculine person named Paul Preciado, who wrote a book called Testo Junkie. And prior to him adopting a trans male identity, trans man identity, he was just like a journalist who identified as like a lesbian or something, you know, used, you know, she, her pronouns or whatever, like just a woman. And she started DIY experimenting with testosterone. It's a sort of like phenomenological DIY, you know, sort of like postmodern experiment, essentially. And the experimentation with testosterone induced the development of a trans masculine identity. And she sort of admits that that is like the causal origins of the identity. He didn't later say like, yeah, this identity was like buried in my soul from like age one, and it just got like revealed through this process of experimentation. The experimentation created the identity out of what otherwise was not there. And so now that we have, and I think, TikTok, like the TikTok surgeon, TikTok gender surgeon, and like, top surgeries for everyone, like, change. And I think this is where, like that sort of Gnostic religious impulse of like, which to me gets into the very like culty sort of new religious movement vibes, where it's like, discover your true self, change your life, this will solve all your problems. It's like an infomercial essentially. And it's like, do this one crazy pill will change your life. It's like an internet ad. So,
Is there anything in your studies of the Continental School that could be helpful in studying this? I think that Foucault would not be far afield of just using his framework around power and how these social attitudes, what's feeding them, how it's proceeding. Do you think, like, okay, reframing, where are you at now with this whole trans thing?
I mean, I'm definitely like, I guess, gender critical adjacent. So this is where it gets tricky, because, prior to very, very recently, I was, had a sort of like libertarian, liberal impulse in regards to adult things. It was like, adults can do whatever they want. Like you can go down to the liquor store of your own free volition and get yourself addicted to alcohol and destroy your life, and we let that be a legal thing to do. And similar with many other destructive tendencies, you can go, gamble and ruin your life. We allow adults to do that of their own free volition. Similarly, you can go to the gender store and like get yourself addicted to transition and destroy your life. And, it's like, and my position was essentially, it's like elective cosmetic surgery, which is a separate question from whether it's medically necessary and whether it should be covered by insurance. But if it's like, you can also go to the plastic surgeon and surgically install whiskers in your face and call yourself a cat. That's like something we just allow in our free liberal society, which is a separate question from like whether we want to, allow pediatric transition, given, maybe they're not capable of giving free volitional consent due to like, the problems of informed consent. But once you get to a certain age. But now, particularly with my recent, Christian convictions in regards to the fact that maybe there's something to natural law theory, maybe there's something to, preserving like a sort of, order that is not subject to the Luciferian will, as you described it, but, something that is good and proper in maintaining like a more conservative order of things. I've been much more amenable to a sort of critique of that liberal vision, insofar as in my own personal life, I've seen the damage that sort of like self-oriented desire had on my own marriage. Because once I detransitioned, I sort of still had these AGP desires that I would sort of occasionally indulge in, but only in the confines of like my house, like sort of, occasionally cross-dressing or whatever. And my wife was like supportive of this, but I sort of realized that, this was causing a conflict between, the health of my marriage. And it's not like she like shamed me into this, or she didn't like, she was supportive. So this is like something I decided of like my own free will, but I realized that, there was something good and proper in regards to sacrificing my own internal desires to try and integrate this AGP stuff into my male identity, versus like sort of sacrificing the desire to give into that impulse and sort of resist the the temptation, and then using like, you know, my Christian faith as like a bolster to provide like a moral imperative to sort of prioritize my marriage as opposed to the prioritization of my selfish desire to indulge in my AGP during like a private, you know, masturbatory like session or whatever.
It's just, I mean, it goes to the, heart of a very prescient reconsideration of liberalism going on right now politically and just online, I guess. It's like, can we be in a free society? Can, like, we're all adults, so we should all be able to do what we want, but we know that human nature, such as it is, will destroy that peace and destroy that common domain where we expect a certain sort of behavior. We expect limitations on behavior within the public sphere, and the private sphere without the controls of morality that extends beyond that public sphere into the private sphere is going to start to percolate more and more things that will pop out onto the public sphere and start to degenerate that respectable thing. So we want a liberal society. I don't want to tell you what to do. I don't want you telling me what to do. But if you start acting in your own self-interests primarily, it's going to affect everybody around you. It's eventually going to affect the society. It's going to get into my kids, right? You know, like the whole thing, you're not just an island. So I guess it's just such a tricky wicket to thread. And yet if for it to be real, for it to actually be authentic, that is your nobility of soul, your nobility of spirit, it has to come from your own lessons. You have to learn the lesson that this behavior that I indulge in is putting myself first and is in fact leading me further and further away from connection, let's just say. And if I sacrifice myself in that way, I actually benefit from being closer to my wife, let's just say what you're saying. And then, but that trickles out of your house, like your connection with your wife, as you work on that, makes you more noble. And then you start to project that energy, I guess you could say, through all of your actions, through all your deeds. And then plus like the benefits are spill out of just your own private life into the public sphere and stuff like that. But you had to go through that. We have to go through that. We have to allow other people to go through that themselves.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think that's absolutely right. Like this isn't something you can like, you can't like humans cannot impose that on other humans necessarily. Like I wouldn't want, you know, like if I, you know, derive my moral vision for what's good from, you know, the Christian worldview, I wouldn't want another religious worldview to gain political power and then impose that via force, which is why I do sort of think that liberalism as a political mechanism is good, given that we live in a fundamentally pluralistic society with all these competing worldviews. And so I think the job of, you know, the Christian is not necessarily to impose the conservative order via force, but to sort of live a Christ-like life, to live a good life. And then, you know, at least according to the Bible, like the Holy Spirit has to draw you into this life. You have to sort of see it from your own eyes. Like, just saying like, oh, you're a sinner, or you're wrong, or you're living like a decadent lifestyle. Like just having another human tell you that, like, that's not going to convince anyone. So you have to kind of be the change you want to see, and sort of, and this is where I think, you know, learning the lessons of you know, the Bible in terms of like, you know, judge not lest you be judged. You have to actually, you can't just run around like saying like, decadent lifestyle, sinner. Like you have to sort of like, you know, I think you have to just like live a good life, be a good person, show love and kindness to people. And then if they see that, and if they come to their dark night of the soul, you know, people will get drawn to that if that's like the will of God. Otherwise, I think we do have to allow these liberal mechanisms, because I wouldn't want, you know, someone to impose Sharia law or something like on my, you know, worldview, which is why I think we do need liberalism. But I think, you know, it's definitely a tough, tricky thing, because, you know, we can sort of see maybe like negative effects in the world, but I think the answer is always love and not sort of like judgment.
I thought of the back of my head was just chewing on this radical consent model, and I figured out what it is. It's fuck around, find out. That's radical consent. Like, yeah, do whatever you want and reap the consequences, right? That's the only form. That's the most radical consent. It's like, you don't know, nobody knows. So you fuck around, you find out. But if you don't fuck around, you're never going to find out. And there's that great little like diagram that the guy does. Like, well, you can, if you fuck around this much, you'll find out that much. But if you don't fuck around at all, you won't find out anything. You know, so it's like the radical consent is, it unfolds first personally. What do you do with, how have you gone through the process of, I guess, accepting responsibility for transition? Like, I guess if you detransition, you give up on that identity, and then at some point you say, well, I did these things to my body. You have to deal with your own responsibility in that. But also, what are your thoughts on the people who facilitated this, the medical industry? What are the thoughts, and how would you propose or go along the lines of combating the, or I don't know, challenging or seeking more gatekeeping? Like, where are you at with regard to what you achieved through that, and how available or not available it should be?
Yeah. So I recognize that different detransitioners have a sort of different philosophy about this, and I think it's probably relative to the extent to which they were, like, you know, physically harmed via medical malpractice. Like, luckily I didn't have any surgeries, so, you know, my ability to bounce back from the transition medicalization, like, I was just on hormones for 8 years, but, you know, once I stopped those, you know, but nevertheless, you know, I'm you know, I'm it just got a fertility test back. It's like, pretty much nothing's there. So I think I have to accept the responsibility of, you know, possibly being permanently sterile. And I know some detransitioners, you know, and I think it's their prerogative to do this, you know, sort of, you know, put the blame on, you know, the medical doctors who should have known better. But for me personally, in terms of just moving forward and dealing with it, I accept some amount of accountability. I have to own that decision. I did that. I was not a child. I was 28 years old. I was an adult. I wasn't psychotic. I wasn't like, you know, I didn't have any, you know, radically false beliefs. I read the informed consent model. I knew that there was like these health consequences, which I also suffered. I had a pulmonary embolism from the estrogen, actually. Yeah.
How did that affect you?
So the oral estrogen impacts your liver, and it also has a tendency to make basically deep vein thrombosis more likely. And I had a history of smoking at the time. So the combination of oral estrogen plus the history of smoking led to a pulmonary embolism. Also, the oral estrogen led to increased triglycerides, which gave me a form of pancreatitis. So I went to the hospital for pancreatitis, and in the hospital, I had a pulmonary embolism. Luckily, I was in the hospital. Otherwise, you know, I could have died. You know, pulmonary embolism is like a big deal, very serious. I don't recommend the oral form of estrogen because it has to be processed by the liver, which has like many bad side effects. Going back to the accountability thing, like, there was certainly an element in which the cultural zeitgeist, like, my therapist at the time, I was talking about my cross dressing, and she was like, you know, oh, you should go watch this, like, story, this interview with Caitlyn Jenner. Your story sounds just like hers. Like, maybe you're trans. And it's like, you know, and also, you know, going on my internet research, like, you know, I typed in, you know, it's sort of like the classic question a lot of like AGP trans women ask themselves, like, is it just a fetish? You see, like, you know, that's the most common question that AGPs have before they start their transition. It's just a fetish. You go on Reddit, you type in, you know, the keywords to search for these narratives about, you know, why do I have a euphoria boner? And they'll like to say, like, that's normal, that's expected. You don't have AGP. That's a debunked transphobic pseudoscience. Like, you're just like, you know, you like, you know, regular women experience this too. No big deal. So you kind of, you know, there's a whole entire cottage industry on the online trans world that basically says, you know, it's not a fetish. This is normal. You are really a trans woman. No cis push person would ever have these thoughts. So therefore you must be trans. And like, you know, and yeah, I could sit here and like blame all that, but ultimately of my own free will, I made a decision and, you know, I take ownership for that. But in terms of preventing other people from being harmed, I think for one, educating people about AGP and like trying to get people to realize that, like, no, it's not transphobic to talk about AGP. You know, because if I had a proper understanding of what was really going on, like when I read Phil Ilya's book, actually, I saw your interview with him, like kind of right around the time I detransitioned. That was like revelatory. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like what's really going on with my life. Because I kind of knew about AGP, but I always thought it was a debunked pseudoscientific transphobic theory until I read Phil Ilya and I was like, oh my gosh, this is actually the real thing that's happening. And now I see more and more sort of people who are, you know, even like trans identified and like, you know, also AGP identified and recognizing. I think that knowledge and education is like the first step to making truly informed decisions.
Okay. Yeah. I guess like the other counter to that fuck around, find out is actually to educate yourself. You do it. You either do it yourself or you do the semi-smart thing. You look around what's happened to other people. And so putting out those stories is the only way I know how to facilitate the changing of this zeitgeist through interviews with you and Ellie and other detransitioners.
I was going to say, I think the problem with like trying to educate people though, is that, I think this is the problem with the informed consent model, is that it doesn't matter how much you educate people, like the heart, the human will wants what it wants and it will stop at nothing to get it. You can read a 10-page essay about all the negative effects of hormones. And if that's what you want, it's going to go through one ear and out the other. You can have your doctor lecture you extensively on how you're going to increase your risk for, like, you know, heart attack or whatever. It doesn't matter. That's what you want, because I think AGP, I've come to realize this and recently, but AGP has an addictive, obsessive component such that once you start dipping your toes, it's like a snowball, it escalates. And once you get, it's like, you know, it's like trying to educate a heroin addict about the dangers of heroin. Like, it just kind of doesn't matter, that the will, the human desire sort of overpowers everything. And like, and once you kind of get it in your mind, you'll destroy your marriage. You'll, you know, put your career at risk. You'll put your health at risk because you just want this so bad and nothing will stop you. So I kind of worry that informed consent is kind of like, it's just sort of going through the motions, which is what a lot of trans activists say. It's like, well, yeah, like it's just going through the motions, but it's not really doing anything. So unless you're willing to just like ban it outright, like, I'm not sure how much we can do except changing the larger cultural zeitgeist about the contagion aspect of this thing, which I feel like, you know, your channel and like that sort of like, you know, these sort of cultural reprogramming and kind of providing alternative narratives is the more like useful thing, rather than thinking we're going to solve this with like policy.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a big thing. I mean, policy with regards to child medical transition is absolutely necessary, or at least the levers of accountability to those who participate in that practice of sterilizing a generation of children under the idea that they're not what they are. So we get to change them. That's the other Luciferian thing. It's like the Frankensteinian thing. It's like these, those, that's another thing. Like why people are wanting to do this, to other people. A big question. What was it that changed your path there? What was the back again?
First and foremost, it was like a health related, but kind of stepping back a little bit. So, my wife and I had someone close to us, like a close friend, and this person, was trans masculine identifying, and, you know, there was some political stuff happening in our state in regards to, you know, sort of trying to put in, you know, gatekeeping measures and blah, blah, blah. And, so this person who is trans masculine, you know, wanted to get, you know, surgery and hormones. And also they had like their children were also trans and non-binary, and their like friends were all trans and non-binary with trans kids. And so it's like, so, and this activism was very important to them. So they were pressuring my wife to, you know, get involved in this activism, you know, go testify at the state house, blah, blah, blah. And so, but at the time, due to this person's like obsession with all things trans, we had, it led to a falling out of the relationship. And so, but my wife, she was like, well, you want me to do research on this pediatric kids thing? Well, before I start doing activism, I'm going to figure out what I really think about this. I'm actually going to do my research. So she started exposing herself to, you know, things like GenSpect and gender wider lens and like, you know, gender critical narratives, and sort of really like looking at not just like the trans activist echo chamber, but looking at the full spectrum of information, you know, including like your channel and stuff. And so when she started watching this, I sort of started listening to some of this. I started listening to deep transition narratives for the first time. And it wasn't for the first time, it wasn't like some remote hypothetical. It was like, it created a possibility model of like, wow, this is something I could actually do. And it genuinely never occurred to me that like detransition was like an option. I was like, well, I guess I'm stuck in this. And okay. It's not like it wasn't like miserable, but also I was tired of being a medical patient, and I was tired of, being abnormal. Like I really craved being normal because I didn't pass out like a 100%. I blended in reasonably well, which is maybe hard to imagine from this you know how I look now, but you know, I blended it reasonably well, but I still always stuck out, and I always had all this anxiety about passing. I'm just like, I wanted to blend into a crowd and not be the person who stands out in the crowd. I wanted to be normal. And so the combination of like watching detransition stories, exposing myself to gender critical beliefs, sort of like having an ideological worldview shift in regards to transness itself. So the health stuff, the gender ideology shift, being skeptical of gender ideology, you know, wanting to be normal, you know, like the fact that I didn't want to be on these drugs for the rest of my life. I didn't want to go to the doctor's office every 3 months to get my blood work done for the rest of my life. I didn't want surgery. And if I wasn't going to get surgery, I'd had to be on this testosterone blocker for the rest of my life. And I just like, I wanted to be more natural and whole. So I actually medically detransitioned first. And then, you know, I started, you know, getting more masculine. I was like, well, it's going to be hard to maintain this social identity. And I was just like tired of like shaving all the time and like putting all this effort into being feminine. I just wanted to be myself. I was tired of like putting on this like caricature essentially. And then I was like, well, I'm just going to fully socially detransition. And the rest is history. That was like last summer.
Really? 2022?
2023.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
Yes. Pretty recently.
Yeah. What was it like for you to come back online, testosteronally speaking?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I noticed was like increased physical vigor and vitality. Like I just felt, you know, and it was great because, you know, when I pre-transition, I've always been into like physical fitness and weightlifting and all these things. Then when I was, you know, identifying as trans, I sort of limited to the extent to which I engaged in that sort of like physical exercise because I didn't want to bulk up and make myself more masculine. So, but now, you know, but having the testosterone in me again, you know, I felt more vigor, more vitality, more energy, like more at home in my body. And there's just like little things that it's, you kind of take for granted. But for example, people don't think about this, but a lot of trans women, their trans trained voices that they do, they're very like kind of affected and dainty. Well, it's very hard to maintain that artificial trans trained voice and yell and scream. To scream at the top of your lungs, your masculinization will come out when you elevate your. So for 8 years, I never yelled. So I never screamed. And so it's like, I went to like a concert after I detransitioned. I was like, for the first time, I was able to like yell and scream and not feel like, you know, this dysphoria about like my voice. It's just like little tiny things like that, like fully embracing the whole range of like my voice, not feeling like I have to keep my voice in a certain sort of like register and intonation, and I can't dip into like the full range of like my expression and like, you know, how I carry myself, and just like finally losing that self-consciousness of like, do I pass, do I not pass, are people judging me, are people looking at me, can they tell, can they not tell? Because I was one of those people where like I would kind of pass a lot until I opened my mouth. So I was always just like, I would get gendered female. I was like, well, now I don't want to open my mouth because then they're going to like get confused. And I'm like, I just hated living in this like kind of ambiguous world. It's very frustrating psychologically. So that was like the biggest thing with detransition, was like having a fully integrated personality such that I don't feel like this duality of like, you know, of self.
Yeah. How was Christianity instrumental for you?
So, I mean, this comes down to after I had detransitioned, you know, I still sort of had the, you know, the urge to occasionally cross-dress. Like the AGP didn't like go away just because I detransitioned. And for the longest time, or, you know, when I first detransitioned, I was like, well, I'm going to try and integrate this into my life, but I'm just going to like keep it very compartmentalized. So, you know, I'll have a sort of, you know, cross-dressing session. you know, keep in mind this is a paraphilia, so it's sexual in nature.
Yeah.
And then when the testosterone came back online, I became much more horny, because so all these sort of like original testosterone driven paraphilic, desires that originated my desire to transition in the first place kind of came back online. So now I'm sort of living with this duality of like, you know, being, trying to be a masculine husband, but feeling this conflict such that the sexual energy I would pour into this AGP was sort of like taking away from my sex life with my wife. Like it was kind of like the more energy I poured into the AGP, the more it would take away from the intrinsic pleasure and my ability to self-sacrifice and like maximize the the goodness of my sex life with my wife. So I eventually realized that, I visited my family over the holidays, and my dad, you know, has, been a Christian since he was my age. So he came to Jesus at like 20, at 35, and he was telling me about his story. And he said, like, yeah, I had a terrible pornography addiction until I found Jesus. And sort of like the light bulb went off in my head, like, well, yeah, I also have a sexual addiction to the indulgence of AGP. And so I kind of had this, you know, I guess a come to Jesus moment in terms of like, well, I'm going to dedicate my life to Christ, give it a shot. And I finally had a realization that I believed in sin as a metaphysical, ethical category. Like my whole life as like a atheist skeptic, I never believed in sin as like a metaphysical reality. It's a very hedonistic philosophy of like, oh yeah, like if I have a desire, as long as I'm not hurting anyone, like, you know, how can it be bad? It's like, it's hedonistic. It's just self-pleasure, like no big deal. But I finally came to the acceptance that like, it was like in violation of my moral obligations to self-sacrifice for my wife. And so, and it's sort of been the only thing that's been able to, you know, keep me from feeling this temptation to like live out, you know, to sort of indulge in these like selfish desires, which was sort of revelatory to me, because I had always sort of thought that like there's nothing wrong with having like this selfish, hedonistic, you know, if it feels good, it must be proper. So that's kind of like the connection. Then once that came true, you know, I actually started reengaging with like, you know, like a spiritual life and developing like an actual spiritual life.
Is that working out for you?
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah. I feel like, I think as an intellectual, as like an academic or someone who, you know, grew up in, you know, very atheistic academic environments, there's a certain amount of like intellectual embarrassment around using theological language that I'm still sort of like coming to terms with and getting used to. But, you know, I really do feel like, you know, putting trust in a higher moral authority that is, you know, God, that is Jesus Christ, and truly believing that. Because prior to this, I'd always sort of had a kind of esoteric, metaphorical appreciation of the Christian story, but I never truly believed it. I never truly believed in the resurrection or any of these sort of like theological, you know, doctrines. It was like, I was like, yeah, I like Christianity, but just minus all the doctrinal stuff. But it wasn't until I fully put faith and trust in the doctrines, in addition to doing like apologetics, you know, research in terms of the evidential basis for some of these things, that sort of solidified my, you know, faith and reason for this sorts of stuff. But I've genuinely seen it having a transformative effect on my ability to be a better husband and a better person and a better man. And to me, that's all the proof I need.
Yeah. Yeah. By the fruits.
Yeah.
So, I wanted to have you and your wife on, and we decided to do it separately. Hopefully we get to do it together. At some point, maybe. That's just a hope of mine, because, I want to understand what she went through, because there's this phenomenon called the trans widow, right? But she's like the reverse. She's a de-trans widow. She married a woman. Well, she married a trans woman, or she married a man who's now a man. Like the must have been very rich material for couples discussion. I'm sure you guys had a lot to talk about. Probably like learned a lot about each other and yourselves by sharing this process of detransition. A lot of the detransitioners that I've spoken to do this really on their own. There's been a couple of, like, I think you're the second married man to go through this process. So I don't want to talk about her. I hope to have that discussion with you guys together. But I don't know. Is there anything you want to say to that? I can even imagine listening to this and thinking, well, I kind of do want to detransition, but my wife, you know, like there's that relationship aspect of that. And I wonder like if there's any insights or what you've learned or gained by going through that process together.
Yeah. I mean, doing this with her, I think was critical, particularly insofar as there was an ideological shift and having more gender critical oriented beliefs, because, you know, going through that process of challenging trans ideology together was useful, because if it had just been one of us, there would have been a reluctance to explore these beliefs because we were both pretty firmly enmeshed in like the trans queer social circles of progressive, you know, left of center, you know, political ideology. And so, you know, there's this constant looming threat of like, am I a bigot? Am I a transphobe? And so like being able to explore these, you know, worldview shifts with someone, while not necessarily having your partner be so quick to be like, oh, you must be a bad person. Like we had the freedom to explore this stuff together in a safe way where we could like challenge each other. And like, you know, maybe she would go more extreme on one, you know, one belief, and then you would, I'd push back, or maybe I'd go more extreme, you know. And now it's like, I'm maybe becoming more conservative. And, you know, now with the whole Christian thing, like that's sort of like this thing, but we have sort of like a safe space to explore, you know, differences of opinion outside of like, you know, what's politically correct, in a way that, you know, and having that partner to do that together with and have these conversations has been really critical to, I think, you know, this development. Whereas if I was just like, you know, embedded into like a social group that didn't allow that freedom of thought, you know, it would have been a lot harder. I probably would have, you know, never even like started exposing myself to gender critical stuff, because it's like considered transphobic to even follow people who are deemed, you know, on social media. You're not even supposed to like follow. There's like someone got like fired for like following Blair White on social media. I don't know if you remember that. Like, yeah. So it's just like, you're supposed to, there's like ethical obligations to stay in your echo chamber. And so just having the freedom to explore, you know, and then that kind of has led to like a destabilization of many aspects of like my whole worldview. You know, like I started listening to like, you know, James Lindsay's work, and, you know, not, and like challenging, you know, many other orthodoxies of the progressive woke world. So now it's sort of like my whole political worldview like has shifted, not just on the trans question, but in many other dimensions. Yeah. So that's been really interesting, because it's kind of curious how gender is like this linchpin that holds together so many like ideological beliefs. And once you pull up the linchpin on the trans question, you start realizing like, well, what else might be, you know, totally wrong.
What are you working on now? Where do you put your access?
I have a YouTube channel, so I've been making videos on there since I started my detransition. So it's been like a fun little project. I have fun with that. You know, I talk a lot of, at first it was more just like kind of personal autobiographical about my detransition. And then over time I started, you know, being more openly critical of, you know, gender ideology. And and now I'm sort of, you know, it's kind of like a platform for me to talk about whatever I'm interested in, which, you know, now that I'm getting really into Christianity, like maybe okay, I'll shift gears once again. But I still, you know, there's a lot of rich, fertile crossover between like, you know, gender, trans stuff and Christianity, and, you know, lots of, you know, things to explore in that dimension. So I don't know. And I'm on Twitter these days, you know, and I sometimes write probably obnoxiously long tweets on X because I'm still a writer at heart, and you know, I kind of, you know, might have a project in the works that I'm working on, like a longer form project. That's
do you feel booked yet?
Like, I've like wanted to write another book for so many years. It's just like my interests keep changing. I can never stick to a single topic for long enough. But I usually just I'm always writing about whatever I'm going through at the moment. So it depends on like if the thing I'm going through lasts long enough to like maintain my persistent interest in writing on this topic. But I've really been wanting to write a book on spirituality for a long time. So I have started working on something in that dimension related to Christianity. So we'll see. Yeah.
Spirituality is a, what does that even mean? Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Having a appreciation for the reality of the divine, the appreciation for the fact that, in my opinion, there's more to the world than just the purely physical material world of atoms and the void. Like, that we're not just meat machines, you know, who evolved according to, you know, random mechanistic natural causation, but that there's in some sense a divine reality. But, you know, with this sort of spiritual world, we can always sort of gesture at it. I don't think it's possible to like precisely define in propositional language and ascribe it like properties in the way we talk about the properties of like a rock or a tree, because it's sort of to some extent always ineffable. And that, in that respect, I think the mystical element comes in, where we can only kind of say what it's not. We know it's not finite. It's not contingent. It's not, you know, whatever. We can say all these things that it's not, but saying like what it is, I think it's hard.
Yeah, it's tricky. You have to really show it, like between the gaps of explanation, show it in your behavior. It's a behavioral connection. In my estimation, there's a connection. You tell people that, foster that connection, and how they behave, how they interact with things, how they feel. It's evident that they're fostering connection with that. So there's a reality.
There's plenty of people who, you know, profess, you know, and said, "Oh yeah, I believe in Christ," but they don't show any evidence of acting that way. And so I think, yeah, you have to, if your belief in Christ has zero effect on your behavior, I would be doubtful the extent to which you truly have a belief in him. But that's like a contentious theological debate. I know sort of the traditional evangelical, it's more about a profession of a belief. And then once you have you say the right thing, you profess the right thing, and then you're sort of, your soul is saved in the internal register of heaven. And, you know, you sort of secure your place in the afterlife based on the profession of like a specific doctrinal proposition. But I sort of definitely think that unless there's a manifestation of, like you said, like, you know, positive, you know, unless you're actually showing love and kindness in your life, like, you know, to what extent can you really be said to be a Christian? Which is not to say that the sort of like liberal Christianity is that Christianity is nothing but just like, you know, social programs and being kind to the poor. And like, you know, I think you can go too far in the like, oh, it's just about doing good things because Jesus was just a good ethical teacher. It's like, you know, I think you have to believe that he was who he said he was. Because I, you know, I think that sort of doctrinal belief that, you know, he truly was divine is important. But I think it is that true belief in his divinity is what leads to the transformation. It's not just like, oh yeah, he was a good teacher. So you have to kind of like, you know, balance that out a little bit.
Great stuff. You have a lot of writing to do and thinking to do, so you're not going to be shutting up anytime soon, I imagine.
This is a very like fertile time for me intellectually. I feel like I'm got a million things I'm interested in. Because I've just like, and I've had people express to me that like, oh, I went from one ideology to another ideology, from one cult to another cult. Like this clearly shows, like I'm not capable of grounding myself in any sort of like rational thought because, I should just, but I don't know. I sort of think everyone has an ideology. Everyone is like, it's just a matter of being honest about what your worldview presuppositions are.
Ray Williams, where can people find your stuff? Just say it out loud. And I'll put links to all of your work in the description.
On YouTube and Twitter slash X, Ray Alex Williams. If you search me on there, you will find me.
Are you aiming? What's 2024 looking for you? Like, what do you want to do? You have a goal?
I mean, I would love for my YouTube channel to get more popular. I don't know. I just sort of, we'll see. I'm just, just want to put more content out there and, just kind of, I guess I'm engaged in quote unquote gender critical activism these days, but at the same time, I have a newfound, religious conviction and, I feel compelled to talk about that. So maybe a combination of those two, goals, to sort of share my faith more, but also to, talk about, things that I care about, which is clearly the harmful aspects of gender ideology and, talking about detransition. And so, yeah, those are kind of my two interests right now.
It's fascinating stuff. There's a lot there. I would be interested in a more phenomenological approach if you ever ended up roping those ideas into this topic. I think it would be fertile ground. Not a lot of people are operating on that philosophical level. It'd be nice to hear more like philosophical stuff about this idea of identity.
Yeah, I do get pretty philosophical on my YouTube channel sometimes. But yeah, I think I could pull together something from various Twitter threads I've engaged in that are more on the theoretical side of things, and maybe there's like a potential book project there as well. I'm not sure.
Well, cool. Keep at it. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm gonna end the recording now. Give your wife my positive regard, and thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Benjamin. This is fantastic. Really enjoyed the conversation. And I really appreciate your whole channel, like everything you do. Big fan.
Cool. It's good to hear that. It helps me to keep doing it. That
Yeah, it was
stuff.
definitely instrumental in my own like worldview shift and detransition itself. So like just listening to these stories like is, like it's almost like a social contagion of detransition itself, flipping the switch a little bit on the sort of like the because I think it's about these possibility models. And like if you don't have a possibility model that detransition is a thing that you can do and not have your life ruined, that there can be positivity on the other side of detransition. So yeah, definitely keep up the good work. Super appreciate it.
We will. Absolutely.